Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. On this President's Day, we begin our show with a close look at the story of an unsung hero of the Revolutionary War. On Christmas night of 1776, George Washington crossed the ice-choked Delaware River with a flotilla of troops heading to an eventual and pivotal victory over the Hessians at Trenton. Oliver Cromwell was among the contingent who accompanied Washington during a fierce winter storm that night, a soldier and a black man, one of thousands of African heritage who served across the Continental Army. Cromwell was born and died in Burlington County, New Jersey. He was awarded the Badge of Merit by Washington, but his remains lie in an unmarked grave, and until recently, there was little to no official recognition of his historic service. This will soon change, however, with a ceremony and dedication of an historical marker on his behalf, thanks to efforts spearheaded by the Daughters of the American Revolution. We have two guests to help tell Cromwell's story. Jane Fox Long is Oliver Cromwell's great-great-great-great-granddaughter. Welcome, Jane.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure. And Deb Vizdosh is historian for the New Jersey State Society of the Daughters of the American Revolution. Welcome to you as well, Deb.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's first get a sense of Oliver Cromwell's accomplishments in the Continental Army. He served, about 6 years and was known as a courageous and a tenacious soldier. Deb, tell us more.
Yes, he was. He was a private. His official enlistment date was February 5th, 1777, and he was in Captain James Lowry's company of the 2nd Regiment in New Jersey Continental Line. He participated in the Battle of Brandywine. He also fought in the battles of Short Hill, Monmouth, Germantown, and he was also wintered at Valley Forge, where everyone knows it was a grueling winter. He has a very storied military career in those 6 years. He ended it with the Battle of Yorktown. And as we all know, and now at this point, he was awarded the Badge of Merit, which was signed by General George Washington.
And of course, he is believed to have been with Washington on Christmas night in 1776 when he crossed the Delaware River, when Washington did. Jane Fox Long, Oliver Cromwell's story is not really well known outside of South Jersey, but it is within your family. Tell us about that.
As you mentioned, I am the 4th great-granddaughter to him, and growing up, that's what we were told. My mother, whose mother had told her, and I'm sure whose mother had told her, was that he had crossed the Delaware and that we, with George Washington. So growing up, that's what we always heard, and that he had served. And hearing Washington, because that was the name you learned in school as the first president, and of course his military record, but to hear a connection for the family was something that just went on from generations and told amongst our family as a connection in history and a source of pride as well.
Washington grew increasingly uncomfortable with the concept of slavery, although he was a slave owner. Jane, he's said to have initially opposed the recruitment of African Americans to the Continental Army, and yet Washington and Cromwell are said to have shared a close relationship. It feels complicated. What is your thinking here?
I think conflicted. Of course, as a slave owner, it's kind of hard to say that you disapprove of it when you still have that. But I think that when you see the value of the human instead of their station, that causes conflict. And I think when he was able to possibly put it aside and see him for the man that he was and what he was bringing to the table as a soldier who was willing to lay his life down for the country that didn't support him, I think that that may cause a little bit of conflict, and it has over the years.
Is the effort to get recognition for Oliver Cromwell overdue, in your opinion, Jane?
Everybody asked that one. I'm sure my family would say, absolutely, it's overdue. And in some ways, I think it is, but mostly I don't focus on what was, but what is, and it definitely is time. It's more than time, and it's finally time for not just Burlington and Burlington County to know about it, for it to go out even further, to let that little piece of history, a little-known black history fact, be known to others.
So your generation didn't have the official recognition of Cromwell's Revolutionary War service, but your grandchildren and their descendants will. How does this change or shift the narrative for them?
I don't think it does. I think it does for people that they know, but because we pass it down, we're not looking for the world to validate him or our family. We've known it, and that's how our history's been passed down often. You don't have it in the history books, but it's been passed down from generation to generation. It'll be nice for them to go and be able to point and say, hey, I'm connected to him. We're connected. And I think that gives a sense of pride, but it doesn't validate them anymore because we never needed the outside validation.
Deb Bizdosh, back to you. Oliver Cromwell lived on East Union Street in Burlington, and you met with the current owner of the home about a marker for the house. What was his reaction?
He was very, very excited. Everyone came out, and he's just honored. And currently, there's a veteran living in the home, so it's very fitting that we're honoring a veteran with the veteran living in the home. It's truly a historic moment, and it's definitely time to honor Private Oliver Cromwell. I'm very, very excited to do this. The research took me all down different paths, but it ultimately led me to be able to place this marker on his home.
Well, speaking of the research, he died in 1853, and you needed proof of his residence before that marker could be approved. Tell us about how you found that proof.
In order to be able to do that, I had to place him on East Union Street. It took almost 3 years. I finished the research in this past December, and I had to go back through the records to find a deed, and that was an 1848 deed from somebody that owned the land next door to the Cromwell land. Oliver Cromwell did not own the land, but the deed next door placed him there on East Union Street. And that was the one piece of paper that I needed. And when I found it, I was just over the moon. It was like finding a needle in a haystack. And unindexed records, and as a researcher, that's what you're looking for. And I found it, and it was just unbelievable.
That's just terrific. Jane, back to you. You told our producer, Paige Murray Bessler, it was important to you that Oliver Cromwell was able to stay in Burlington, and of course, we talk about the early 19th century. You know, that was not a given at the time for a black man. Liberty was not assured. Why was this important to you?
It's important because years later, family was there, and it was centralized. It's very interesting to me that his home that you're talking about is just around the corner from the house that I grew up in, that my mother grew up in, her family. My mother was the youngest of 12, so his great-great-granddaughter, I think that would make my grandmother, lived in that home and raised her children, and it was just around the corner that, growing up, we didn't know about that piece, so it just ties it back even more that it solidifies the family connection to his history and what was done for the country.
Yeah. And, you know, he came home to Burlington after the Revolutionary War, but apparently Cromwell had to, you know, quote, know his place, end quote, as a black man, even as he was a decorated veteran of the Revolutionary War. You know, not knowing Oliver Cromwell, of course, what do you think he might make of the effort to recognize his service today, Jane?
Now, he might say it's about time, simply because he did what he did and fought against others, but I'm sure if we look historically, others have been recognized long before, and had his skin and race been a little bit different, the story would have been very different. It wouldn't have taken as many years to have it. There'd be a marker. There'd be, you know, his gravesite. All those things would automatically be there. But it's something that people have had to fight for, and as Deb said, it's taken her 3 years to do it, and we're in 2022. So it's a long time after the fact, but it's time.
Yeah. Oliver Cromwell's remains were cremated in an unmarked burial, and Deb, you say this was not uncommon for the time.
No, it wasn't. My research took me to the cemetery, and you know, I read through. There were three newspaper articles, and I researched each one of them line by line to see if I could find any other indication of his burial or any information. And he is interned in Broad Street Cemetery, and
in Burlington. Yeah.
in Burlington, yes. And I tried to go that avenue to have a marker placed there, and it just didn't work out. So I had to regroup and thought, what better than the actual home that he lived in, where he sat on his porch? And if you read the newspaper articles and the interviews, he sat there and he waved at people, he talked to people, he shared his story. And so to me, I think it's fitting to go and put the marker on a place where he sat and he told his stories. I've reached out to other societies to try to have a marker placed somewhere near the cemetery so that we can recognize the fact that he is buried there. That's something that's in the works, but I don't have any concrete information on that yet.
Deb, there are relatively few New Jerseyans of African descent who are documented for their service in the Revolutionary War. So does the work continue for the Daughters of the American Revolution to bring them recognition?
Absolutely. And from the story that's gone public, I've already had other organizations reach out and say, hey, can you help me find any more information about this patriot or this person? And I've already started researching and doing as much as I can to help other people and other organizations.
It's not easy, though. I know your research was challenging, you know, even with major entities like the National Archives. I mean, you went to the National Archives for information about Oliver Cromwell's pension. And what, you got crickets?
I did, from the National Archives, yes. Unfortunately, I sent off the request in February of 2020. And as we all know, the pandemic started in March of 2020, and I have not received back any information. I was hoping for an additional, more personal packet back on his pension. Sometimes there are those included, and I was hoping for that. And to this day, I have not received back my pension request from the National Archive.
Jane, are you going to be at the ceremony, which is set for April 27th?
I will be leaving the day before, so I'm front and center to see the ceremony. My mother died a few years ago, and she was the one that always told me, don't ever forget, your great-great-great-great grandfather was with Washington, and he crossed the Delaware, and all those things. And she's not here to see it. So for me, that'll be me standing in place, representing our family as well as her. So that will be a time of pride for me to be able to step in the gap for her, because she's not here to see it for herself.
Listen, it sounds like it's just a terrific milestone, and great to have Mr. Cromwell's history officially recognized. And we really appreciate your participation in our show today. Jane Fox Long, descendant of American Revolutionary War soldier Private Oliver Cromwell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Deb Vizdosh, you as well, historian for the New Jersey State Society, Daughters of the American Revolution. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Up next, we're going to talk about the debate over controversial speech on college campuses. Stay tuned for more of the Regional Roundup.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In this next interview, we're going to address a question which is roiling many colleges and universities, and that is whether controversial figures whose speech or actions might be deemed offensive should be given a platform to express their views on campus. There have been a few examples locally in recent months. Maria Paula Romo is a former minister of government for Ecuador, whose invitation by Penn to do unpaid research spurred an online petition from thousands of opponents. Romo has been accused of allowing police to use tear gas canisters during anti-government protests. And Penn State supported the right of a student group to invite right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos, even as it expressed repugnance repugnance rather, for Yiannopoulos' views. At stake, said Penn State, was the First Amendment. Other institutions have taken a different tack, disinviting such figures. So what place should contentious speech or protest hold in campus discourse? Sigal Ben-Porath is a professor of education at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is author of the book Free Speech on Campus. Welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you so much for having me.
And let me give the number in case folks want to touch base and join the conversation. 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. So, Sigal, let's begin by talking about students. Protest is nothing new. You point out in your book there were rowdy and sometimes violent marches during the time of the Vietnam War, and free speech was at the heart of campus struggles then. So flash forward to today. Students can be just as fervent. And in a presentation on YouTube a few years back, as chair of Penn's Committee on Open Expression, you said you got the sense that the way students were being portrayed wasn't necessarily justified. Tell us more.
Well, it's pretty common these days to talk about students as being coddled, as being snowflakes, as being overly sensitive, and really to blame them for refusing to listen to opinions that are counter to their own. But in fact, through my work as the chair of the Committee on Open Expression at Penn, as well as, you know, working around many, many campuses in the U.S. and internationally since then, I've really come to realize that students are really trying to push for greater commitment to democratic values that we all are, or many of us are, advocating for, right? So if we are looking to make sure that our public spaces are welcoming to everyone, that people can speak freely and express their views, we have to make sure that the kind of speech that we're endorsing, especially at educational institutions, is not a speech that is silencing or excluding some members of our community. And so students are really pushing for that. And sometimes they do it, you know, zealously, and sometimes they need to be educated about appropriate ways of protesting or objecting to certain opinions. But I really think that rather than trying to reject or criticize students, we ought to listen to them because, generationally speaking, they have something important to say.
Yeah. So as far as university leadership is concerned, generally, you know, across the country on college campuses, let's use the example of Milo Yiannopoulos, who, you know, often in his speech is transphobic and et cetera. Are there benefits to students in interacting with controversial, even offensive speakers? As I said in the introduction, some proponents say this, you know, teaches students how to question inflammatory speech.
Right. So I definitely think that there is a lot of benefit to interacting with speakers who you disagree with their views, right? But some people, and I think Milo is a case in point, and there are some other ones, a handful of them, really are not there to interact, to engage, to challenge. They are there to troll, you know. They are there to just express as extreme view as they can in order to enrage, and oftentimes in order to benefit themselves, maybe selling a book or getting speakers' fees. This is not, in my view, a productive place for the university. I'm not saying that these speakers don't have a place in the public sphere. It's not an effort to silence them. But the university is in the business of knowledge. It's in the business of expanding minds and thinking about ideas. If you want to be grand, it's in the business of truth, right? And so really, I don't think that the university needs to be committed to hosting people who are there only just to serve as provocations rather than looking to engage and really expand minds. And I really think that the most important place for a university is not in being part of a general marketplace of ideas. You know, Of course, it's a part of what we do. And of course, we are committed to maintaining a commitment to the legal boundaries of speech and the First Amendment, etc. But the marketplace of ideas that we endorse is one that is based on scientific principles, on ideas of promoting truth and knowledge for the common good. And so the people who we choose to invite should be ones that are committed to similar ideas and that are helping us to promote them.
Yeah. Well, Penn's campus, as so many others, is diverse, and not everybody is going to agree with everybody else. So how should university leadership separate the trolls, if you will, from the legitimate, if you will, speakers whose opinions might be offensive to, say somebody who's more conservative versus somebody who's liberal, or liberal versus conservative, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that the university itself, even administratively, is a very diverse space, right? So we have a lot of different units. You mentioned the Romo case.
Yes.
This is an invitation that came out of a specific unit within the University of Pennsylvania. It's not a university appointment, right? And so part of what university leaders need to do, and are actually normally pretty good at doing, definitely at Penn, but in many other places too, is really to let the different units operate independently, right? If you have a department or a center or a student group, let them do the work of figuring out who's an interesting speaker, engaging, relevant, thoughtful speaker, and let them do the invitation. Universities, and again, it's definitely typical of Penn, do not engage in reviewing and censoring speakers or visitors that are coming to the different units. And part of the diversity of thought that we are able to incorporate into our daily work, and part of the reason why universities are such robust and lively context for free expression and for diverse views, is that the university is not speaking in one voice, and the university leader is not really going over the list of invitees and making sure that everyone adheres by the party line. You know, we have speakers coming from many diverse perspectives, and this is our strength, right? And so this is really a diversified set of inviters or context into which the speakers come. And of course, sometimes, you know, generating disagreement or even protest or even a strong objection. And that is a part of what we do, right? And we need to protect the opportunity that students and others would have to object to some of the speakers coming in. That doesn't mean that we would disinvite them or silence them.
Right.
It would really just mean that we will hear counter voices in response to their views.
So let's get some parameters around objection. So, you know, if students are passionate and they don't like perhaps what a speaker might be having to say, how should the dialogue look? I mean, sometimes, you know, the thought occurred to me that, well, you know, if a speaker, say, is shouted down, then there's no conversation there. I'm not saying wrong or right. I'm just saying, well, you can't really hear and perhaps not respond in a way that might be fruitful. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, there are some efforts around the country, notably at the University of California, Irvine, to try and create very clear parameters for appropriate protests and responses. And there is surely a concern about students or others using what is sometimes called the heckler's veto, right? So yeah, Basically heckling or shouting down a speaker to the point that the conversation cannot continue. This is really an issue on the very, very narrow margins of events that we are hosting.
Sure.
But we need to pay attention to that as well. And I think one of the important ways of doing so is by initially creating the conditions where the speaker is not standing on a platform and pontificating or trying to persuade students and others with their views, but rather creating contexts in which there is initially engagement set up as a part of the event.
So right? what does the event look like? What does the setup look like then?
So, for example, one of the ways in which we've been doing it, and one of the ways in which colleague, for example, at Middlebury, after they've had some issues, have developed
Charles Murray.
Right,
yeah,
platforms. Right, for doing that through their engaged listening project, is really to try and, for example, start off with the speaker speaking for a minute or two, and then we have small group conversations and exchanges where the speaker is walking around and engaging with the audience, and then we can have a more open maybe lecture or a small talk offered by the speaker, and then you have a more open and interactive exchange with the visitor or the speaker that is not just based on, 10 minutes, two or three questions, as is the typical academic structure, but rather allowing the speaker to more deeply engage through a workshop context or through other formats with diverse opinions and with responses, including evolving responses to their views. Well, you said something I really didn't think about. I think I disagree, but let me try to process this, to work this through with you, right? Rather than resorting to shouting or leaving because really my voice has not been given any space in the context of this event, right?
We are speaking with Sigal Ben-Parath, Professor of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. And I just did want to kind of refresh for our listeners. We'd actually addressed the Middlebury College story a number of years ago in which Charles Murray, author of The Bell Curve, controversial publication, tried to speak, and then there was such a that there were some injuries in the crowd and et cetera. So that's, in moving forward, you were addressing that. Sigal, how should we define hate speech on a college campus?
Well, I think, first of all, before we even define, it's important to remember that hate speech is protected by the First Amendment. And so, in fact, even if we reach a clear definition of hate speech, that doesn't mean that we are going to censor, prevent, or punish it, right? Because it is protected speech, legally speaking. However, at the university, what we need to think about is how do we create an inclusive climate where diverse views and diverse people are able to be heard, to speak and be heard, right? And so hate speech for me is really a form of expression that is silencing to some people in the audience, right? And so, for example, if you are questioning whether people with certain identities belong in your classroom or on your campus, and if you are expressing a strong view that they don't belong or that they have nothing to contribute, or you are questioning their standing as someone who can know, right? Because we are focusing on knowledge in our work. These are all potentially forms of hate speech. But what does that mean, right? It means that you are not doing your work. If you're a professor, right? If I'm engaging in hate speech, I'm actually failing in my work as a teacher, as a researcher, because if I cannot hear the voices of some of my students or others in my classroom, then I am unable to take into account the diverse perspectives that I have to work with, right? And so I think what we need to do with hate speech is really we need to figure out a way, first of all, to ensure that it does not actually silence people that are members of our community or around our community, our learning community or our campus community. And then we need to figure out a way to counterbalance the burden that hate speech puts on the shoulders of those people who are being silenced, right? So we need to represent our values of inclusion more effectively.
The ACLU, which, you know, fights for the free expression of all ideas, says that, you know, where, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, where hate speech is concerned, more speech, not less, is the answer. So, in other words, to counter with more speech.
Right, although I do think that sometimes at an educational setting or a learning setting, hate speech really has no room, right? So the ACLU speaks, of course, about the general democratic context, and that's, of course, accurate. But in a learning community, sometimes you can say that this view doesn't have room in my class.
Well, we're running short on time. I want to get to a couple of comments here. Dave tweets, hosting provocative views that are held in good faith is part of the college experience. Hosting grifters, like the ones who you cited, and I'm assuming he's referring to Milo Yiannopoulos, is encouraging grifters. All controversial or inflammatory speech is not created equal. And then we have an email from Patty who says, some of the extremists with inflammatory speech seek to talk at events on campuses in bad faith. Their goal is to inflame and put the university in the position that if they decline to invite them to speak, university officials are open to accusations of hypocrisy and of not supporting the free exchange of ideas. I've got about a minute left. What are your thoughts?
So I really agree with that. A university is not in the business of platforming. A university is in the business of inquiry. This is what we do. We are looking to expand knowledge for the public and common good, right? And so people who are willing to engage with that and who are coming in good faith should be welcome with their diverse opinions and views. People who are looking for other causes, you know, can rent, you know, a platform elsewhere. And public universities cannot always make these distinctions because they are more restricted by the First Amendment requirements than private institutions. But in terms of what we are committed to doing, we are committed to inclusion, truth, and knowledge, right? And so we are looking to engage with others who share these values.
Now, 30 seconds left. Should students be part of the invitation process?
Surely students themselves do a lot of invitation through their organizations on campus. And in some cases, it's definitely appropriate to engage students in the process. Students are part of our search committees for new colleagues. They are sometimes part of selecting visitors, and it's quite appropriate to have them participate. It's a learning experience, and their voice is important.
Sigal Ben-Parath, thank you so much for joining us. Went very quickly. We appreciate your visit. Professor of Education at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Free Speech on Campus. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we talk about how the fashion industry, one of the biggest polluters when it comes to production and garment waste, is turning around a bit with the help of some entrepreneurs. We'll speak with Camille Tagle of FabScrap. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. One of the most exciting trends in fashion is the move towards sustainability. Millions of tons of waste fabric end up in U.S. landfills every year. And according to the World Economic Forum, the fashion supply chain is one of the planet's biggest greenhouse gas polluters. Philadelphia itself is now becoming a center of the sustainability and textile recycling movement, featuring homegrown zero-waste designers and nonprofits like FabScrap. FabScrap partners with various fashion and interior design companies and individuals to give a second life to thousands of pounds of textiles left over from the design process. It's a fascinating operation with the potential to be a sustainability game changer. And joining us now to help tell this story is Camille Tagle, co-founder and creative director of FabScrap. Hi, Camille. Welcome.
Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're really happy to have you with us today. So FabScrap originated in Brooklyn and opened its Philly location at the Bock Building a couple months ago. And from what I understand, Camille, literally hundreds, even thousands of pounds of textile leftovers are given to you by businesses and individuals. Describe what typically happens on the sixth floor of the Bock Building.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been in operation in New York for the past few years. We've just celebrated our fifth anniversary, and that was also when we opened our new Philadelphia location. But I would say, you know, to date, we've saved nearly 1 million pounds of fabric from landfill,
wow,
which is a huge amount. And that kind of gives some context to just how much waste is happening in the supply chains. But basically, once a brand decides to sign up for our recycling service, which if you imagine, you know, how cardboard or plastic recycling works, where there's, you know, a truck that shows up at your location and carts away the waste, we function pretty much exactly the same. It's just that we specialize in fabric. And so when all of those materials get collected from our brand partners, we bring it to our warehouse and sort them, and that's how we figure out how to keep them out of landfill.
Well, I was looking at some pictures of the sorting process. I mean, this operation looks like a fabric lover's fantasy. There are bolts of fabric, piles of neatly folded pieces. Describe some of the so-called waste that FabScrap receives from its partners.
Oh my gosh, I would love to. And you're totally right. It is honestly a creative lover's dream when you walk into our reuse room. And you know, the unfortunate thing is that it is called waste, but all of the materials that we receive are anything but. I mean, we, of course, have scraps and small pieces of fabric, but we honestly rescue, you know, rolls of fabric, like fabric yardage, and full skins of leather hides, and cones of yarn, trims, literally anything that you would need to make some sort of creative project out of textiles or any apparel materials we have, and we're able to offer that to the public at thrift store pricing.
So there are there difficult fabrics to give a second life to, and what happens to them?
That's a really great question, and that's something that we explain in our volunteer program. So in order to kind of go through the volume of textile waste that we receive, we do require and rely on volunteer help, and part of that is sorting through the materials that we receive to be able to separate them by fiber type. So we do a quick orientation just to, you know, teach people who have never really interacted with fabric before. It can get pretty complex with the different compositions and fiber types, but we kind of show them what to look for. And anything that contains spandex, unfortunately, can't be downcycled into insulation. And so those are one of the fabric types that are kind of the biggest opportunity for upcycling, you know, especially when they're in small, you know, little pieces and are not yardage. That's when we have creatives who really take that opportunity to think outside the box and create just even art or really amazing pieces by thinking outside of the box and redesigning with things that typically are very difficult to reuse and normally get discarded.
So what are some of the ramifications, Camille, of the fabric that does end up in landfills?
I think, you know, it's easy to kind of get lost with, you know, thinking about all the glamour of fashion and all the beautiful materials that we receive at our warehouse and in our reuse room. But I think ultimately we have to connect that back to climate change. So any fabrics or materials that are either ending up in landfill or becoming incinerated or burned, that has a huge devastating impact on climate change. And so, you know, as much as we are so excited to see, you know, what is made from all of these fabrics and the different things that everyone is able to upcycle and different creative projects that they're able to pursue, we always want to still tie that back to the idea that they're also helping, honestly, with that goal to combat climate change.
And just let's take a moment to define upcycle, downcycle, that sort of thing, if you could.
Yeah, I'd love to get into that. So, you know, with sustainability, there are all these really fancy ways of referring to things, and that distinguishing between those two is something that we focus a lot on with our awareness and our education. So upcycling would be kind of taking something and elevating it back into another another item. So basically, any sort of fabric, spandex, scrap pieces that, let's say, they're kind of like odd corners and little bits, we have some designers that upcycle them into new fabric. And what they do is they'll piece together or quilt together all those little pieces and make a new fabric and then make a new, let's say, T-shirt or dress. So that would be a really great example of upcycling. Downcycling is something, one of the ways that we keep the really small pieces out of landfill, in which they are turned into a different type of material by kind of, you know, rearranging their form. And like I would say an example would be, you know, when we convert things into insulation, that process requires all the fabrics being pulled apart and all of their fibers are kind of shredded almost, if you want to imagine it that way. And then that's repurposed into different types of insulation. So you could have really compact, thick insulation for car doors. You could have really thin insulation for like moving blankets. You could have things for walls and flooring. So that would be a different way of kind of converting what the product used to be and then shredding it or pulling it apart down to insulation.
It's really exciting. Our guest is Camille Tagel, co-founder and creative director of FabScrap. Lines are open, 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Melanie asks a question. She says, I'm an upholsterer and I hate wasting scrap fabric. Do you only work with big companies with lots of fabric, or could I donate small pieces of leftover fabrics? What do you say, Camille?
I really love this question because we welcome anyone to honestly recycle with us. We do, you know, provide our service mostly to brands. However, if you wanted to drop off at our location at the Bach Building, we do allow individuals to drop off their textile waste for recycling.
Now, let's talk about some definitions in fashion, fast fashion and slow fashion. Fast fashion first, which, as I understand it, Camille, is the production of mass quantities of less expensive, trendy garments. Maybe, you know, you buy a piece, it's not particularly well made, but then maybe, you know, you could just toss it when it's out of style or falling apart. Are we seeing the beginning of the end of fast fashion?
I am very hopeful and honestly would like to say yes. I think the awareness honestly has really increased in the past few years, and I noticed that a lot more designers who are entering the industry are really thinking about every single part of the supply chain and their effects to what their own decisions in design and in building their company kind of have in terms of the long term. So that's been really amazing to see. And honestly, the more we educate, the better the understanding is, I think, not just within fashion, but also in other industries. But yes, we've definitely done a lot of work with different schools in the area, and really been challenging those designers who are about to enter the industry to rethink some of the more antiquated ways of design.
So then what is slow fashion?
To me, slow fashion is honestly just, it can take a variety of ways, but it's really thinking through all the different ways to be more environmentally conscious and also more socially conscious. I think we need to think in terms of, you know, both where we're sourcing and how we're using those resources, from, you know, sourcing the fabric to also the production and who's making our garments, and are they being treated fairly, and are they being paying a living wage? So all of those factors into design, you know, what different approaches can we take instead of, you know, the typical ways of cutting a pattern piece, maybe draping in a way where there's, you know, less cuts required and therefore less waste. So just so many different ways, I think, in structuring, you know, a company, whether it's in fashion or elsewhere, to basically think through all the different steps and understand one's kind of effect from each of those parts.
So when a company sends FabScrap a load of fabrics, you know, or zippers or buttons, apparently you weigh it all, and then the brand gets an environmental impact report. What does the company learn about its process, essentially about how to perhaps do it better?
Absolutely, and that is something that we're really proud to share with our brand partners. So every year, a brand will receive kind of almost a report card, like a total of pounds that they've recycled with us, and we break that down and what that means in terms of carbon offset and also what that means in terms of trees planted. But it gives a breakdown of, you know, what percentage of the total pounds they've recycled with us ended up being reused and into our thrift store system, how much of that actually was downcycled into insulation, and then how much of it had really no choice but to go to landfill. And so I think when brands have this report card generated for them and have all of this information at their disposal, it really allows them to reevaluate internally what some of their sourcing decisions are. Maybe they want to invest in fabrics that have less spandex, knowing that spandex is something that we can't recycle easily. Yeah. It really is a guide and a tool for them to evaluate their own business practices.
We've got a tweet from Sandy who says, fabric and waste from a garment from before a garment is even put on display takes up so much more space in landfills than people realize. It's insane. And then an email from Julia who says, when my mother was a girl, her mom made quilts out of pieces from a factory that had men's wool scraps. You know, back in the day, when people didn't have as much, there wasn't much that was wasted.
100%. And even, you know, in Italy, for example, there are people who are called, I think, raggers, and they would go around and pick up all everyone's fabric scraps and clothing scraps and actually make paper with it. So it's something that, honestly, I think we've just become a little out of touch with in terms of really valuing our resources and understanding that, you know, not everything is automatically waste. There are so many different ways to, like, look at what we have called waste lately and really, you know, trying to understand, like, the value of it and the resources that went into it in order to be a little bit more eco-friendly and a little bit more conscious about our impact.
I imagine that with some of the fabric pieces that you have at the Bach building, that there can be some really fantastic pieces of clothing made.
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, to be able to have this available to the public and have the public gain access to all of these things that end up in landfill is something that very personally is near and dear to me. My background is in design, and I was one of the people who kind of contributed to the issues when I was working in the fashion industry. And, you know, it was mind-blowing for me to learn as I was designing just how much reusable fabric goes to landfill. I would say of the total amount that we collect from our brand partners, about 60% is actually completely usable.
Wow.
And again, that's, you know, full rolls of fabric and, you know, hides, leather hides or fur hides that haven't even been touched. And a lot of those things, and I can speak firsthand, a lot of those things are thrown, honestly, because of just simple design changes or, you know, certain sales changes or things that happen just during that that process. And so for me to see, you know, students being able to take advantage of these materials and really, you know, enhance their projects and their knowledge of design by having access to it, or having entrepreneurs, you know, say that having access to this also allows them to really grow their business. It's something really meaningful, and everyone kind of wins because it's another way of keeping these materials out of landfill.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we only have about 30 seconds left, but is there a piece that stands out in your mind that was made from some of this repurposed fabric that you could describe for
us?
Oh
my gosh, we've seen so many beautiful and amazing things, but we are also really happy to have a future designer program, which we'll be launching immediately in Philadelphia in the next week or so. So for anyone who is interested in visiting our warehouse, definitely come by the Bock Building or check out our website, fabscrap.org.
And you love your volunteers too, and they are rewarded. If you love
absolutely,
fabric.
Absolutely, right? Yes. Anyone who volunteers with us, we give a special 5-pound fabric thank you that they can take home with them.
All right, Camille Tagle, such an interesting and enlightening conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Best of luck. Camille Tagle is co-founder and creative director of FabScrap. Our engineer today is Al Banks, our producer, Paige Marie Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you with us, and be well.